From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with writer Tom Wolfe. After two decades at the forefront of the new journalism he helped create, Wolfe recently branched into fiction. His first novel, The Bonfire of the Vanities, has been on the New York Times bestseller list for nearly half a year. Also today, I speak with character comedian Eugene Levy. He stars in a Cinemax comedy special as Bobby Bittman, the showbiz comic he created for the SCTV comedy series. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews three albums from black vocalists pushing the boundaries of their genres. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new comedy Beetlejuice. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Radical chic and the me decade are just two of the expressions coined by Tom Wolfe. New journalism is the tag that was given the style he wrote in and championed. The new journalism used the techniques of fiction, descriptive scene setting, dramatic tension, and dialogue. And as far as Wolfe was concerned, new journalism wiped out the novel as literature's main event. In his new and flamboyant style, Wolfe wrote about Ken Kesey's LSD experiments in the book Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test. Wolfe's essay Radical Chic mocked white liberals eating fancy hors d'oeuvres at a fundraising party for the Black Panthers. And The Right Stuff conveyed the macho drive of America's astronauts. Tom Wolfe, the journalist who once called contemporary fiction retrograde, recently wrote his first novel. It's titled The Bonfire of the Vanities, and it's been on the bestseller list for about half a year. I spoke with Tom Wolfe from the NPR Bureau in New York. Since his journalism appropriated the techniques of fiction, I asked him if he used his journalistic skills in researching the novel.
I tried to. I spent, I don't even want to admit how many years doing reporting and research. Well, I guess it must have been, it was, you know, a good 2.5 years doing reporting and research for this novel, because I wanted it to be as completely grounded in fact, in terms of the situations, as anything in nonfiction. In fact, I had originally intended to do a nonfiction Vanity Fair based on Thackeray's Vanity Fair, only would be in nonfiction. And finally, when I had sort of the breathing spell to do it, I said, wait a minute, I think I'll just turn it over. Having never done a novel, and do a novel, but prepare for it as if I were writing nonfiction.
Do you see this novel as bringing you work full cycle?
No, I haven't thought of it that way at all. At first, it was a piece of curiosity. I was curious as to what would happen if I did try to do a novel. I was curious about just sort of throwing down this challenge to myself. I have bad-mouthed contemporary fiction so much.
That's right.
It's just awful.
I was going to get to that.
I've been a little outrageous about it. And so I said, even though I'm asking for a lot of trouble, I'm just going to throw down the gauntlet to myself and see what will happen if I do it. And having done that, I'll say I'm now going to try to prove that not only possible to write a realistic, even naturalistic fiction about today, but that it's desirable to do it. So I also wanted to prove a literary point.
You've always mocked journalists who aspired to write a novel as if that were a higher calling than journalism was. And now I've been wondering if you've always been a closet wannabe novelist yourself.
Well, I, at the very least, I didn't want to reach the point where I reached the end of my career and look back and say, gee, I wonder what would have happened if I'd ever written a novel. Because, you know, all of us, if we're serious about writing, and it was as true when I was in college as it is when people are in college today, all of us start off with the idea that if you're going to write, you're going to write a novel. And that's the way I started off. But then I became fascinated in the early 60s with the notion of experimenting in nonfiction. That's been the great passion of my career. But I said, all right, I'm going to take this detour. I really thought of it as more of a detour than the completion of a cycle. I felt in a way that I had completed a kind of cycle when I finished The Right Stuff. I had done a lot of things that I had wanted to do in nonfiction. So I figured, well, if there's any natural time for me to try a novel, it's right now.
Your new novel explores several different cultures within New York City. One of them is the haves. The main character is an investment banker who's finding it hard to save any money on his $1 million a year income.
Yes.
And he thinks of himself as a master of the universe, someone who can't be a saint because he's a master of the universe and he's too busy and he has too much responsibility. What genre of person do you think that is? Is this a person who typifies a certain attitude in the 80s?
I think it's quite typical of the 80s, that which is a period of tremendous prosperity at certain among certain people in large cities. There's probably never been a period of such prosperity, and particularly in New York, where the world of investment manipulation has created a gigantic industry, by now far and away the biggest industry in terms of dollars and in some ways in terms of just sheer numbers of people in New York City. And it leads, the colossal accumulation of money leads to the belief among those who have it that this accomplishment translates into all areas of life, and that if you are able to make a lot of money, let's say on Wall Street, that you're also able to do anything else that you want to do with your life. In other words, that you are able somehow to be a master of the universe. And this is a great pitfall in every area when you start thinking you can translate an ability in one area into the rest of your life.
So we have the haves and the have-nots in your novel, the haves being symbolized by this, or epitomized by this investment banker, and the have-nots epitomized by your characters in the South Bronx. And the haves are always thinking that they're about to be under attack by the have-nots, and that their Mercedes is going to be damaged, or that they're going to be mugged on the street, or maybe their house will be robbed. Do you think that sums up a certain paranoia in Manhattan in the 80s?
There is an attempt more in the 80s. I've lived in New York for 25 years, and I've never seen it quite as bad as it is now. The feeling that if you have anything, you've got to insulate yourself from the rest of the city, and above all, insulate yourself from the South Bronx. That's why I chose the South Bronx. Even though you could make the argument that there are a couple of places in Brooklyn that are as rough, if you are a Mercedes owner from Park Avenue, as the South Bronx, I think the South Bronx is uppermost in people's minds. That's why I decided to go up there and take a look. I mean, it is a kind of a paranoia. It's not constantly on people's minds, but it's somewhere tucked away in the back of the skull at all times, because there's no question but that street crime is worse now than it has ever been.
So let me ask you, are you going to write more novels now?
I haven't decided. The thing that worries me is that toward the end of this book, I was having fun doing it. I've never had fun writing a book.
That worries you?
Yes, because everything else I've done, it has been torture right up to the end, and yet the thing seemed to work out. I figured maybe something went wrong if I actually enjoyed it toward the end of doing it. I found the flexibility of the novel intimidating. In nonfiction, this nice thing occurs. You're handed the characters, you're handed the plot, and the hard part is bringing it all alive factually. In fiction, you suddenly have this freedom that you can do anything you want with character. And it worried me a lot at the outset. But toward the end, I began to enjoy the flexibility. But I really haven't decided what I'll do.
Now, you got your doctorate in American Studies. Why did you go into journalism? Not that there's a whole lot of professions waiting for people with doctorates in American Studies.
You put your finger on one part of it, and very few people realize that. Oddly enough, the work I did at Yale to get a doctorate in American Studies turned out to be of inestimable value in journalism. It so happened that I finished my dissertation at the end of one summer, and it was too late to get a job teaching, which is the natural thing for someone in graduate school to do. So I decided, well, I'll do something else for a year and get a job teaching the following year. So I got a job on a newspaper in Springfield, Massachusetts, which is a few miles north of New Haven, and somewhat to my surprise, loved it from the very beginning. I was a general assignment reporter covering whatever came my way, filling in on the police beat on the weekends, and I really never wanted to leave it once I got started.
You ended up in the features department. Was that considered more trivial than political reporting?
Well, I never actually was confined to feature work, but certainly feature work and general assignment local reporting, which was my real passion, was considered far, far beneath reporting on national and international news. And as a matter of fact, I got a job on the Washington Post immediately when I applied, because I was the only applicant they had had in about 5 years who had walked in and when asked the question, what would you like to do eventually here on the Washington Post, replied, cover local news. They said, you're hired, because the place was full of bitter young men and women who had come to the Washington Post to cover the Defense Department or the Senate or Paris. And I just found local news in the cities of this, covering local news in the cities of this country, a carnival.
You started to use the techniques of fiction to write journalistic stories. What were you reacting against in the style of journalism?
There was a neutral, so-called objective voice that journalists were expected to assume at that time. And now we're getting back to the late 50s and the early 60s. And I frankly found it absolutely boring. I also, having had it in the back of my mind that I was, you know, at some point I was going to quit journalism and write fiction. I mean, that's what everyone interested in writing starts into journalism with. That's the idea. I began to be intrigued with the notion of, well, here I am a journalist, well, why not use, if it's possible, some of these techniques that short story writers and novelists use while doing nonfiction. And this became a great game and a great experiment, and pretty soon, by the mid-60s, seemed to me much more important than writing fiction. I mean, there was nothing going on in fiction that even remotely compared in excitement with what was going on in what at that time was called the new journalism.
Was it a sudden thing that got you to write that way? Did you suddenly say, well, I can't write this piece in the old style, I've got to write it in this new style, the old style just won't work? Or did your writing gradually evolve?
No, well, I did have a kind of a involuntary, epiphanal moment in, let's see, what year was it? It was 1963, it must have been. There was a, late in 62, a newspaper strike began. I was by now working for the New York Herald Tribune, and I suddenly found myself out of a job, and I needed to make some money, so I went over to Esquire magazine and sold them on the idea of a story on customized cars, which at that time were being made in very fanciful forms by teenagers in Los Angeles, the era of Big Daddy Ed Roth and George Barris and so on. So they said, okay, going out to California and do this story. I remember checking into the Beverly Wilshire Hotel, and over the course of 4 weeks running up this enormous bill, I came back to New York, found myself utterly blocked. I could not write this story. I went to the managing editor of Esquire, Byron Dobell, who's now editor of American Heritage, and I told him, I said, Byron, I'm sorry, I just simply cannot write this story. I just have to drop the assignment. He says, you can't do that. We've got about $10,000 worth of color plates of these ridiculous automobiles you're supposed to be writing about on the already made. We can't do anything about that. So why don't you just give us your notes, and we'll get some competent writer to put them together. So with a very heavy heart one night, as a matter of fact, it must have been after 9 o'clock at one night, I started typing up these notes in the form of a memo which began, Dear Byron, the first place I saw customized cars was at a teen fair in North Hollywood, California, as straight as I could do it, but as fast as I could do it to get this humiliating task over with. And I ended up typing at top speed for about 8 or 9 hours. And in that time, I produced 50 typewritten pages. I took this over to Esquire, turned it in about 9 o'clock in the morning, went home to sleep, and I got a call about 4 that afternoon from Byron Dobell saying, well, Tom, we're going to knock the Dear Byron off the top of your memo and run the memo as the article. And that article became the one entitled The Candy-Colored Tangerine Flake Streamlined Baby, which was the title of my first book. What had happened was, in writing what I thought was a memorandum to a single individual who was about my own age, Byron Dobell, that I had somehow liberated myself from all of the fears and all of the constraints that you feel when you are going to write something as formal as a magazine article for a national audience. I'd reached that kind of tone that a lot of people are able to reach in writing a letter to a friend. There are many great writers of letters who freeze when they are told to write a course paper.
A lot of people tell you, write it as if you're telling your friend about it. Of course, easier said than done.
Well,
it implies that you're more articulate somehow when you're talking to a friend about it, which isn't, of course, necessarily
not
true.
Not necessarily true, but you are freer, and it'll work the first time for anybody.
Well, that article established a new style for you, which you've been building on for a long time. Now, that style has created real reverberations within journalism, and I want to talk to you a little bit about the legacy of that style. It seems that it spawned a lot of terrific writing, and it spawned a lot of bad writing, too. I don't know if you feel that way. Do you? that there are a lot of excesses that have been...
It can lead to excesses, particularly in the form of purple prose.
Yeah.
It's a very demanding form, and I think a lot of people who try it don't realize how much reporting you have to do first. Without the information behind it, all of these techniques, which are things like scene-by-scene construction and use of extended passages of dialogue and point of view in the Henry James sense, without the facts, which can only be obtained through reporting, it can really fall flat. It just becomes a verbose technique.
There's also a certain kind of novelistic writing that has entered newspapers, where the article might start, it was 4 a.m., little Johnny awakened with a start. There was a big noise outside. He looked out the window. War had broken out. And instead of just the headline saying, war broke out, you have to get through all this descriptive, novelistic writing.
Well, frankly, I don't see it tried enough any longer. I think newspapers particularly tend to be very timid because they don't have to experiment very much any longer. Most towns in the U.S., newspapers have settled down into local monopolies. The great day of this form of writing in newspapers was at the New York Herald Tribune when it was desperately trying to overtake the New York Times. And that's what really started really brilliant work by people like Jimmy Breslin or Gail Sheehy and many others. It didn't, you know, we never overtook the New York Times, but it was we sure made a great show as the ship sank.
My guest is writer Tom Wolfe, who's just written his first novel. It's titled The Bonfire of the Vanities. We're going to talk some more about his work and his life after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Journalist and novelist Tom Wolfe is my guest. Can I ask you the dread questions about your white suits?
Yeah, now we're getting serious. Yes, go ahead.
Let's get down to real business here. I mean, your signature as far as your wardrobe goes has always been the three-piece suit, tailor-made, usually white. Now, something I've always wondered about wearing a white suit is that you really have to protect yourself because anything is going to get you dirty. And as a journalist, it seems to me you really want to dive into a situation and do what needs to be done. But if you're wearing all white, you have to keep everything at a certain distance.
Well, two things that come to mind when you ask about that. One is, I have discovered that for me, you know, maybe it doesn't work for everybody, for me, it is much more effective to arrive in any situation as a man from Mars than to try to fit in. I've tried, when I first started out in journalism, in magazine work particularly, I used to try to fit in. I remember doing a thing on stock car racing. I went down to North Wilkesboro, North Carolina, to do a story on a stock car racer named Junior Johnson. And I tried to fit into the stock car scene. I wore a green tweed suit and a blue button-down shirt and a black knit tie and some brown suede shoes and a brown Borsellino hat. I figured that was really casual, really the stock car races. And after about 5 days, Junior Johnson, whom I was writing about, came to me and says, I don't mean to be rude or anything, he says, but people I've known all my life down here in Ingle Hollow, that was where he came from, say, they keep asking me, Junior, who is that little green man following you around? It was then that it dawned on me that, A, nobody for 50 miles in any direction was wearing a suit of any color, or a tie for that matter, or a hat. And the less said about brown suede shoes, the better, I can assure you. So I wasn't fitting in to start with. I was also depriving myself of the ability to ask some very obvious questions if I thought I fit in. I was dying to know what an overhead cam was. People were always talking about overhead cams, but if you're pretending to fit in, you can't ask these obvious questions. After that, I gave it up. I would turn up always in a suit, and you know, many times a white suit, and just be the village information gatherer. And you'll be amazed if you're willing to strike that role.
When you were doing the research for your book, Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, which is about Ken Kesey and the psychedelic acid trips, were you dressed like that too?
Oh, yes. And to have tried to fit into that scene would have been fatal, perhaps literally fatal. Kesey had this this abiding distaste for pseudo-hippies or hipster. There was really no such term at that time, but... Well, let's call them pseudo hipsters. You know, the journalist or lawyer or teacher who on the weekends puts on his jeans and smokes a little dope and plays some Coltrane records and tries to be part of the scene. And so he had a device called testing people's cool. And I remember once witnessing this. It was on one of these weekends, and he said, "All right, let's everybody get naked." That was his word for naked. And get on our bikes and go up Route 1. This was in California. And they did. They took off all their clothes, they got on their motorcycles, and they started riding up Route 1. Now, this separated the hippies from the weekend hipsters, if you will, very rapidly. But now I didn't have to worry because I was in my three-piece suit with a big blue corduroy necktie, and the idea that I was going to take any of this off for anybody was crazy. So you know, I was safe.
You probably just look like another freak to a lot of freaks.
Well, after about 2 weeks, one of the Ken Kesey's group, the Pranksters, named Doris DeLay, said to me, "You know, you got on the weirdest outfit around here," and it was the most unusual in that particular little corner of the woods.
Would you ever let a journalist observe you, hang out with you? I don't mean just interview you and write a piece about you. Maybe this has happened already. But say a journalist wanted to almost move in with you for a few weeks, really get a sense of your life, follow you around on a story you were writing. Would you let anyone do that?
Probably not. I've never felt that anybody owes me the courtesy or favor of letting me observe them, or that nobody has any obligation to answer my questions. And by the same token, I don't feel I have the obligation to answer anybody else's if I don't want to. I don't think it's an inalienable right of the American press to be cooperated with.
Are you saying that you don't trust journalists?
unless for some reason I really wanted that, and that could, you know, that could occur too. I mean, I could have publicity starvation.
But are you saying that you wouldn't trust someone to come in and watch you, or that you'd just be uncomfortable by it?
I'm not ruling out the possibility of doing such a thing altogether. I'm just sort of stating as a principle that at this moment I probably wouldn't want to do it. The time could come when I might want. You know, most people, if they let the press observe them, are striking an implicit bargain. They feel that they know that there's something in it for the press, and they feel that there's something in it for themselves. And I think we might as well be frank about it. It is some kind of bargain. Not that the outcome is going to be the outcome of what is written should be a certain thing, but that, okay, I'll give you this freedom of observation in hopes that I'm going to get this particular. I think that's the way it works out.
Well, that leads me to my final question, which is some people probably who got written about by you felt burned afterwards, thinking specifically of the Radical Chic piece that you wrote about a fundraising party for the Black Panthers at Leonard Bernstein's house.
Yes,
and, I'm sure he was sorry that you were there.
Yes, I think he was. I think you have to take, as the journalist, you have to take the position that what you are doing is important. That the process of discovery that you are going through is as important, if not more important, than any issue that is involved in the story that you're writing. In looking back at the story on Leonard Bernstein and the Black Panthers, the story Radical Chic, I think it was important to see exactly how the phenomenon that I called Radical Chic worked, what it was all about. And I think you can't afford to be constantly wringing your hands over the impact of what you're doing, whether you're talking about the impact on the individuals that you're writing about or the impact on the issues that are involved, in this case, support for radical groups in the late 1960s. I was heavily criticized after that for drying up fundraising, which I don't think I did, but drying up fundraising for these radical groups among wealthy people, among socialites in New York. Well, whether I did or I didn't, I don't think you can worry about that. I think if you start worrying about that, you're no longer writing. You're involved in public relations.
Tom Wolfe, I want to thank you very much for sharing some of your ideas with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Tom Wolfe's best-selling novel is titled The Bonfire of the Vanities. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Audrey Hepburn. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. There's never been a comic as untalented or unbearable as Bobby Bittman. Thank goodness he's fictitious. Coming up, we talk with character comedian Eugene Levy. He created Bittman for the SCTV comedy series. Now Levy tells Bittman's life story in an upcoming Cinemax special. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new records by three singers, adding to the tradition of the black pop ballad. And Stephen Schiff reviews Beetlejuice, the new supernatural comedy starring Michael Keaton. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. A big jump in the monthly trade deficit for February sent financial markets into a tailspin today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 101 points to close at 2005.64. It's the biggest drop since January. The steep drop follows the report from the Commerce Department, which showed a nearly $1.5 billion increase in the U.S. trade gap. The deficit expanded to $13.8 billion, the highest since last October. Details from NPR's Barbara Mantell.
The reaction in world financial markets to the disappointing trade figure was quick. Within an hour of the announcement, the value of the U.S. dollar had fallen nearly 2.5% against the yen. By the end of the day, after heavy central bank intervention, that decline was cut to 2%. The thinking in the foreign exchange markets was that to shrink the foreign trade gap further, U.S. exports must become cheaper, therefore the dollar must fall more. In the bond market, traders worried that the volatile dollar would discourage foreigners from buying U.S. bonds, and bond prices therefore fell sharply today. Stock prices followed, encouraged by program trading. Analysts say it's too early to tell whether today's sharp decline in stock prices will be extended. I'm Barbara Mantell in New York.
At least one U.S. sailor and four other people were killed when a bomb went off near a club frequented by American military personnel in Naples, Italy today. As many as 20 people may have been injured. Police sources said the explosion may have been caused by one or two car bombs near the USO club. So far, no group has claimed responsibility for the bombing. Islamic hijackers aboard a Kuwaiti jetliner in Algiers today released one of their estimated 35 hostages as negotiations with Algerian officials continued. More from Jim Muir in Cyprus.
Walking with some difficulty, one of the hostages, identified by Algerian officials as Jamar Abdallah Zaki, made his way down the steps, helped by a doctor. He'd been released by the hijackers after a day of negotiations, which intensified with Algerian officials visiting the plane some three times in the space of 2.5 hours during the course of the evening local time. It's not clear why the hijackers have released this hostage, but it follows the same pattern as was set in Cyprus, where they released one rather unwell hostage fairly early on during the negotiations. They described that as a gesture of goodwill. It was similarly described by the negotiators, and it seemed to be in the nature of, as it were, a present to them from the hijackers to keep them interested in continuing their mediation. Jim Muir for National Public Radio in Nicosia, Cyprus.
The Soviet Union today signed an agreement that will lead to the withdrawal of the Red Army from Afghanistan after more than 8 years of war. Soviet Foreign Minister Eduard Shevardnadze and Secretary of State George Shultz signed the accords in Geneva today, along with representatives from Afghanistan and Pakistan. After the signing ceremony, Pakistan's emissary predicted the war will continue after the Soviets leave because there is no provision for an interim government. Albert Gore today won the endorsement of New York City Mayor Edward Koch in the April 19th New York Democratic primary. Koch called Gore head and shoulders above his rivals. He cited the Tennessee senator's commitment to Israel as the main reason for his endorsement. While he supports Gore, Koch said last weekend that he believes frontrunner Michael Dukakis will win the Democratic nomination. A vote reasserting Denmark's peacetime non-nuclear status has sparked a crisis for that country's conservative government. An emergency cabinet meeting is considering an early election after today's vote in parliament. Denmark has banned nuclear weapons on its soil in peacetime for 30 years, but has only assumed that ban was respected. Now visiting warships will be informed of the ban in writing. Denmark's prime minister opposed the reassertion, saying it insults the NATO allies. Right now, the next election is set for 1991. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of three new releases that each add something to the tradition of the black pop ballad.
I remember the first time I danced with you, baby. It was a slow song. The lights were so low.
Pop trends come and go, but ballads by rhythm and blues artists remain alluring. Singers like Smokey Robinson, Stevie Wonder, and Michael Jackson are veteran stars who keep their careers healthy with regular doses of romantic balladry. About 10 years ago, another generation of black balladeers came along. Teddy Pendergrass, Luther Vandross, James Ingram, Peebo Bryson, and groups like The Whispers and Shalimar. They all made music that was a gathering of contradictions, macho and pretty, passionate and silly, subtle and overstated. Good new pop ballads seem to come along with gratifying regularity, and the latest batch is firmly grounded in the tradition. For example, Howard Hewitt, a former singer with Shalimar, has just released his second solo album, Forever and Ever.
I'm trying to recall how it feels to be in a normal state of mind. Time has a game that it plays. With memories and hopes and dreams of our love. Can't take it, can't let it slip away.
Howard Hewitt and Strange Relationship. Hewitt's voice isn't an especially expressive instrument. I think the most interesting thing about that particular performance, in fact, is that he sounds uncannily like Gladys Knight. But its very lack of distinction works in that song's favor, since its point is to articulate the hemming and hawing, the lurching ambivalence of a love affair you're not quite committed to. Even rap music groups are getting into the ballad act these days, staking a claim to this genre as an influence and an ongoing inspiration. The new album by Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five, called On the Strength, is a solid collection of terse rap songs with one clear exception, a ballad called Fly Girl. At the risk of sounding like Steve Allen translating Little Richard lyrics, I'll quickly say that Fly Girl is a street expression for a desirable young woman. Grandmaster Flash and his group employ a veteran vocal act, Ray Goodman and Brown, as well as a singer from the Force MDs, Jesse Daniels, to harmonize on this ballad. The music is placed within the harsher, less sentimental context of rap.
Women in California to the shores of Maine. Fly girls love diamonds and pearls.
Drinking in the champagne, mink coat, have a midnight swoon. Candlelight dinner, maybe on the beach or hot afternoon.
Like to play out and stay out, go way out or lay out on the floor of the shore. Spend the whole day out.
Spend some time with the honey. Most of all, they like to spend money. Cold cash.
Mean green currency that rule a big bank and a strong man is the only thing can rule her. You try to fool her, you might lose her.
The best you could do is school her. Give her fine wine, make love to her mind.
Don't keep her hanging on the line, hope you have a good time.
Caviar for a star, buy a brand new car.
And let her know what kind of man you are.
Cause she's a fly.
The best new ballad around these days is from the oldest artist under discussion here, John Whitehead. I don't mean to make him sound like a doddering old coot, he's only in his late 40s, but his career recapitulates one slice of pop history. Working with his songwriting partner Gene McFadden, Whitehead wrote and produced lots of hits for various vocal groups on the Philadelphia International Records label in the 70s. As that decade came to an end, McFadden and Whitehead scored their own big hit called Ain't No Stoppin' Us Now. John Whitehead has a new album out called I Need Money Bad, and I think the title song is pretty wonderful.
Get a job. You're a menace to society.
Ooh. Oh, said I need it. Oh, well. Suddenly. I'm at the end of my rope. Times have gotten so bad.
I'm finding it hard to cope. Bill collectors keep knocking at my door. It's a crying shame, but I just can't pay them anymore. I don't know how I got in all this debt I'm in. Oh, but I need money back.
What's most obvious in that song is the way Whitehead uses money, so to speak. It operates in the song as a metaphor for romance. I need love bad is the clear message in the chorus. But the song also contradicts the prevailing image of rhythm and blues balladeers these days, which is the expensively dressed love man, the black urban professional who is able to ignore a dicey economy. John Whitehead is following a grand tradition when he brings up mundane matters in a pop context. Just think back to Smokey Robinson and the Miracles' first hit, Got a Job. But Whitehead is extending that tradition in a fresh and, in the context of the times, rather daring way.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. The albums he reviewed were Forever and Ever by Howard Hewitt, On the Strength by Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five, and I Need Money Bad by John Whitehead.
I've just got to find a way. All these bills I've got to pay.
You're listening to Fresh Air.
Ladies and gentlemen, Funny Man, Bobby Bittman.
Bobby Bittman is the epitome of the crass showbiz comic. He's one of the many characters that Eugene Levy created for the SCTV comedy series. The series can still be seen on television in reruns, parodying everything that's wrong with TV and show business. On SCTV, Levy also played news anchor Earl Camembert, Bruno, the hunchbacked assistant to the mad scientist on Monster Chiller Horror Theater, and one of the polka-playing Schmenge brothers. Levy has put his gold chains and nine rings back on to play Bobby Bittman again in a new Cinemax comedy special. It's called The Enigma of Bobby Bittman, and it's a mock documentary about the comic's career on the occasion of his 1 millionth performance.
1 million how are yous later, huh? Yeah, it's been a tough road, all right. It's been a tough road. I had to step on a lot of people to get here.
Can you describe the Bobby Bittman character?
Can I describe the Bobby Bittman character? Well, I would say that Bobby Bittman is without doubt one of the most despicable human beings that one has had the pleasure of seeing perform on a stage or in front of a camera. I guess he was based on a generic kind of comic that came out of the '60s that I grew up watching on television, the kind of stand-ups that played Vegas, the Shecky Greens, and the Alan Kings and the Marty Allens, and he's really obnoxious and loud, and it was a kick for a quiet, shy, kind of likable guy like myself to play.
I love women, you know that? I really do. And if you don't believe me, I can show you some canceled alimony checks, because I got a stack of them. I'll tell you that. Now, I've had so many wedding nights, I could make a week out of them. Yeah.
I love the laugh that you've invented for Bobby Bittman. How did you come up with that, and why did he have to have that kind of laugh?
Well, I think it had something to do with drawing focus to yourself. I think it had something to do with walking into a room and making sure people, saw you coming in, So, I mean, coming in with a line like, "How are you?" you know, your eyes shift and you would look at this fool walking in and you know, for better or worse, you're going to, you know, watch him for a while.
I also love the contrived geniality of that laugh.
Well, everything about the man is contrived.
Right.
I mean, that's the sad, you know, the thing about this particular character. He's really reached new heights of despicability in this thing, and I'm not sure why. I don't know why he's as unlikable as he is.
What was it like for you the first time you saw yourself in the Bobby Bittman toupee with the Bobby Bittman tuxedo type outfit
and
the chains?
Yeah, yeah, that was my own hair when I started doing the show.
Oh, really?
Okay? Yeah, that was not a toupee. That was my own hair. That's the way I used to look. Okay. Now let me. And this is, you know, this is taking. I've grown up a lot in the last few years, so I can say this publicly now. I did look. That was my look. And, you know, Bobby Bittman and you know, Earl Cannonbear, the only difference between the two characters was one wore glasses. You see? It was the only difference between them, because that's the way, that was my look. And how did I feel looking at it? Well, you know, I mean, my wife to this day, and when we got married in 1977, says I married Earl Cannonbear because that was me.
And I should mention for our listeners who aren't familiar with Second City TV, with SCTV, that Earl Cannonbear is the news anchor that you played on there.
Yes, but I think for people who aren't familiar with the show, this is probably going to be kind of a tedious interview, but you know, I mean, really. But for those people who you know, who watched the show and were into the show, I, you know, hope I can shed just a little light on some interesting little tidbits of information that you may have been wondering about.
Can you do stand-up comedy after having done Bobby Bittman for so long? I've never seen you do stand-up, and I don't know if you're even interested in doing it, but it seems to me it would be pretty tough to do it.
After doing
Bittman.
I've had no interest in doing stand-up comedy. I think it would just take... I think you don't have to be insane to do stand-up comedy, but you definitely have to have, like, you know, something missing. I couldn't take that kind of rejection. It would devastate me. My reaction wouldn't be, all right, let's just fix the material and come back again tomorrow night. I'd be on a plane out of that town so fast. I like to do my thinking kind of behind a typewriter. I approach my work the way an actor approaches his work, except my work is comedy. So as a comic actor, that's what I am. When I'm introduced as comedian Eugene Levy, there's an expectation that, you know, I can, you know, come out, get behind a microphone and, you know, keep a room, you know, in stitches for 20 minutes. Well, you know, I don't have 20 minutes. And it is character work, and that's how I get my laughs through the characters.
Tell me about Sid Dithers and how you created him.
How can I say... He's a guy with bad eyesight, and he's not stands maybe 5'2", and
toughest thing about Sid Dithers, as with a couple of characters, was that for some reason I chose to, you know, cross my eyes slightly behind, you know, inch thick lenses, and it was physically, you know, it was like migraine time every time I did the character, but a great character. We never spoke Yiddish in my family. I did not have a handle on any kind of Yiddish dialect. The first time we did the scene where Sid Dithers was in the scene, Harold Ramis told me that his grandfather had one expression that he used to say all the time, and that was,
"So how did you came? You drove and did you flew?"
And I would take that expression, and I kept saying it over and over and over, and finally it launched, you know, the dialect for me, and it really helped. And of course, you know, Sid manages to squeeze that in.
So you didn't have any Jewish grandparents who took Sid Dithers personally?
No. Nobody took Sid Dithers personally, but, you know, there are millions of Sid Dithers out there, and you usually see them driving, you know, behind the wheel. You see their little head behind the wheel of a giant, you know, Olds 98, and the one thing you don't want to do is be driving behind them.
You know, in reading a little bio about you, I learned that you had performed in, I guess it was a roadshow of Godspell, and I was really trying to picture this, and I can tell you I really still have a hard time imagining you in one of these, you know, rock musicals. it seems to be exactly the kind of thing that you'd parody in something that you were doing yourself.
Well, back then, that was the a big show for a lot of us. We had that was in Toronto. We did the show. We had a great company. Myself, Marty Short, was in that show. Andrea Martin was in that show. Paul Schaefer was the musical director.
God,
on that show.
What
Gilda
a strange
Radner
show it must have been.
Was in that show.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of great people, and that was really the first big professional job that all of us had done. You know, I mean, that was like a steady gig. That was like a year contract. You know, playing a major theater in the city. You know, at you know, $165 a week. That was like we thought we'd made it. I mean, we'd actually made it. A steady check coming in for an entire year. And we left that and went right into, you know, Second City, which was a really tough transition, at least for me.
So what kind of directions are you heading in now?
Well, interestingly enough, I'm spending more time writing right now and getting into a, you know, writing, producing type of mode. I'm involved in a development deal right now with Disney Studios, where I'm creating television product for them, and I get to work out of my hometown of Toronto.
So wait, so here's this offer to create, quote, television product. Do you ever worry that you'll end up turning into the kind of television writer that you've always parodied?
Well, this is the thing, and it's a good question, because you know, just about everything we've done outside of SCTV, you always look at it with one eye and say, you know, now wait a minute, you know, should I be doing this? You know, why exactly am I doing this? Or you know, how much better could it be? And is this something we would have parodied on the show? And I don't think I could come up with anything and write something and produce it that I could not get behind from a qualitative standpoint and also from a comedic standpoint.
Well, I wish you the best with your new projects, and I thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thanks so much. My pleasure.
Eugene Levy stars in The Enigma of Bobby Bittman, debuting April 16th on Cinemax.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much.
This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Robert Siegel and see what they have planned. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What do you have today?
Well, we're reporting on the U.S. frigate that was damaged by a mine in the Persian Gulf. Also on day 10 of what is now the Algerian hijack story. Of course, it's a Kuwaiti jet. It's gone from Iran to Cyprus and now to Algeria. Letters from our listeners and coverage of the signing of the agreement calling for the withdrawal of Soviet troops from Afghanistan. The ink was barely dry on that document in Geneva when the president of Pakistan, General Zia, said that the war will go on for another 8 to 9 months, and he did not rule out Pakistan's assistance to Afghan rebels.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Beetlejuice is a new comedy film with a supernatural twist. Film critic Stephen Schiff says its director has successfully used new film techniques to explore some old comic styles.
About 10 years ago, movie special effects achieved a new plateau. With Star Wars and Close Encounters of the Third Kind and Superman, Hollywood's master illusionists proved they could create convincing live-action versions of the sights and sounds you could once find only in animation. The new technology could make a cartoon world look real. Movie makers used their special effects skills to make people fly, and to make spaceships look authentic, and to create increasingly creepy monsters, but they left most of the cartoon legacy untapped. I'm talking about the crazy metamorphic world of the great old Warner Brothers cartoons, for example, in which every natural law was flouted in the name of bamboozling Porky Pig or Daffy Duck. Of the lonely pioneers who actually ventured into this haywire realm, only Joe Dante, who directed Gremlins, has gotten very far. But now Tim Burton joins his ranks with the outlandish new ghost comedy Beetlejuice. The plot centers on a likable young couple called the Maitlands, played by Alec Baldwin and Gina Davis. After they die in a car accident near their idyllic Vermont house, they find they've turned into ghosts, doomed to inhabit that house for the next 125 years. Unfortunately, the house has new tenants, god-awful New Yorkers who want to redecorate and scream at each other. and, in short, make our heroes' lives, or rather their deaths, a living hell. The Maitlands try scaring them away, haunted house style, but they just don't have what it takes. They waft around moaning in designer sheets. But even the new tenant's lugubrious daughter, wonderfully played by Winona Ryder, can see right through them, so to speak.
What do you look like under there?
Aren't you scared?
I'm not scared of sheets. Are you gross under there? Are you Night of the Living Dead under there?
Like it or not, there's only one way to get rid of the new people, and that's to call on a professional ghoul named Beetlejuice, a prolific prince of terror played by Michael Keaton. Unfortunately, the movie waits too long to bring him on at full speed, and while we wait, the director's rampant inventiveness becomes too much of a good thing. Beetlejuice manages to be at once prodigiously imaginative and faintly boring. There's not enough story to support this surfeit of brilliantly cartoony effects. Still, the movie's generosity is pretty winning. The tricks in it bend over backwards to thrill you, and they succeed. And when Michael Keaton is around, he takes the screen by storm. His Beetlejuice is the ultimate lounge lizard, a seedy con man whose cons have the extra spin that supernatural powers confer. And part of the fun in Keaton's performance is the pride his character takes in his accomplishments. Beetlejuice is vain enough to think of himself as an artiste.
I attended Juilliard. I'm a graduate of the Harvard Business School. I travel quite extensively. I lived through the Black Plague, and I had a pretty good time during that. I've seen The Exorcist about 167 times, and it keeps getting funnier every single time I see it. Not to mention the fact that you're talking to a dead guy. Now, what do you think? You think I'm qualified?
The success of this picture may give Michael Keaton's career a boost, and no one deserves it more. As this movie so amply demonstrates, Keaton is right up there with Steve Martin and Robin Williams. He's one of the very best comic actors we have.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with film director Alan Rudolph. His new film, The Moderns, is set in the Paris art scene of the 1920s and stars Keith Carradine, John Lone, and Genevieve Bugeaud. Also, New Orleans pianist and singer Dr. John will pay tribute to one of his own, the New Orleans pianist and singer Cousin Joe. And critic at large Laurie Stone will discuss the new ABC series, Home, so I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Fred Landrell. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.